Welcome back. Now, for people who are just joining in momentarily, just on a whim, clicked on that beautiful little link that I sent on my Instagram channel. Independent Incidentals on Instagram, of course. They're probably wondering what I thought, what I sounded like when I said, what I said on my Instagram story, so I will repeat what I said, this time with actual audio. Get ready for it. We're getting royal up in here! We're getting so royal! Oh, days of days, gather your loots, everybody! We're getting so royal! Absolutely royal, I could not believe how royal we're getting right now. Oh, yes. I deserve the crown, yes. I deserve it. It is in my birthright. Of course. Some of you in the audience might not think I deserve the crown as the prince of Radio Laurier, but one day I shall steal it from everyone. Yes, I will. I will steal it from the king of Laurier. Laurier himself. On his throne in the clouds. Yes, I will. I will sneak up there. I'll get my best men on the job to build a ladder up to the skies. Pull him down, get his crown. And I will frown if that will not come to pass. Yes. Oh, welcome back, audience. Oh. Today was a bit of a dreary day, if I do say so myself. I was tasked with so many arduous tasks and projects and things of the sort that Laurier himself has decreed on me. But one day, those will not come to pass. I shall come back in full force. It's simply because of the barometric pressure in the air. Yes, I do declare. My eyes are feeling like they're gonna sink out of my skull at any moment, but I'm doing all right, everybody. I'm doing all right. Okay, that's, man, my throat was very scratchy for a sec. I think I zoned out for, like, at least 3 minutes. What happened? Huh. Anyway, besides the point. Today's topic. Who would have thought? Who would have guessed? Based on such a royal, sorry, royal intro. It's Thronefall. I can't help but roll the R. It's slowly infecting me. The royalness is infecting me. Oh gods! No, I gotta keep it in. Okay. All right. So let's begin. Thronefall. Thronefall is a very more so, I'd say, niche game, perhaps, in a way, because from what I've seen, not a lot of people are covering it, even with its new release. This 1.0 release came out in October 11th, if I do remember correctly. And I haven't seen a lot of people talking about it, even though, surprisingly, it has 15,000 positive reviews, over 15,000 positive reviews on Steam. And it just got a new port on the Nintendo Switch. So, let's dive in. Why Thronefall? Why is this game niche? That's the first question that we have to ask ourselves. Because this is called Independent Incidentals, after all. I can't break away from the namesake. Why is this niche? Well, because of the first thing I mentioned. Not a lot of people are talking about it. Not a lot of circulation is happening. And maybe that's because of the lack of a marketing executive, perhaps. Or maybe they just don't want to really, they don't feel like they have to really do it. Because I'll get to that in a moment. But their background is quite interesting. There's a few other topics at hand, too. So, we'll go through each of the questions and we'll answer them sequentially. How about that? Make it a little more structured for you all. Make sure that you aren't getting bored or lazy. Yes, yes. We gotta make sure you're intrigued. Very intrigued indeed. All right. Now, let's begin. Question one is, the first question that you might ask is, who made Thronefall? What's their story? What's their background? What other games have they influenced? Have they made that influenced the creation of Thronefall? Now, quite an interesting first question. The answer is the fact that they were developed. This game was developed by Grizzly Games. I'm talking like I'm in Jeopardy right now. Who was the first person who made Thronefall? What is their story? Well, I guess that'd be in the form of an answer then. Whatever. Point is, Thronefall was developed by Grizzly Games, and their bases of operations, their headquarters, takes place in Germany. The studio has been focused on making minimalist games. What they mean by that is games that can be picked up by everyone and don't take more than 30 minutes a gaming session. We're not talking about non-complex games. A lot of games can be complex. However, their style, their simplicity, and their way to communicate the rules to the audience can be simple. Which is this game, I feel like, is their best selling point, among a few other things, which we'll get to in a moment. The members of Grizzly Games have studied, and I think are continuing to study, if I'm not mistaken, at HTW Berlin, which is a public university that offers game design in their course selection. You can major in game design at this university. There's a few other universities in Canada and a few other places too that provide you with a gaming major, a game design major, but this university can get away with it, amongst a few other ones, because they're European. And money is expensive, everybody. Ladles and germs. Money is quite expensive. It stands to reason that these games are being developed here. So there are a few examples of their games that they made over the past couple of years. Superflight is a game that was made in 2017, and I actually had it in my Steam library. Who knew? Because it was like, what? It was like on sale for 50% off, and the game itself is literally like $4. Not even. It's a perfect little buy, if I do say so myself, even though I never played it. However, from the promotional materials and the trailer, I noticed that there are a lot of simplistic design that I kind of carries over to Thronefall as well. Islander is another one that's more of a building, city builder game, which also takes a lot of the style that they kind of developed over the years into Thronefall. But these games, like I mentioned before, are a product of them being in Europe. Because there is a specific genre of presumably board games called a Euro game. The result of these easy access, this easy access to the games industry for students, as we've mentioned before, is popularizing this idea of the Euro game and making it even bigger on a more digital scale. Games like Catan, Ticket to Ride, and Carcassonne are examples of a board game Euro game. They tend to be complex in their rules, yet sleek in their design and their teaching philosophy, how they're able to communicate these ideas and new concepts to the player. Of course, I'll keep using Catan because it's easy and accessible to a lot of people, because it's the game that people know the most. The pieces themselves in Catan, the pieces that you see, are very well distinguished. You can easily tell the difference between a house, a settlement, as it's called, and a city, versus a road. And even in the other expansions, you got little boats, even soldiers in some cases. They get the more complex, the more you delve into the expansions. However, the original Catan is very sleek in the way it describes and explains these kind of more so abstract rules and concepts. Two more characteristics of Euro games before we dive into how this game progresses. There's two things: a point system and an end state. The winner is declared by the total amount of points you have. There's multiple ways to get points, and there has to be a definite end to the game. Rather than theoretically prolonging the game forever like Monopoly, Catan has a set point limit. You have to reach 10 points in order for the game to end. Ticket to Ride also has a train car minimum that, once exceeded, declares the final round, and Gargascone requires the last tile to be placed until the game ends. Monopoly, you can steal as much money as possible, and until everyone is done in the ground, I guess technically, in a way, there is an end state. But this end state in Monopoly can be extended forever, continuously, ad nauseum. With Catan and Carcassonne and Ticket to Ride, there's always forward momentum. You're always putting more cars down, you're always getting more points. And you're always placing tiles down, right? You can't unplace a tile, you can't unplace a train car, you can't unplace a settlement. Even if you can steal specific rewards like longest route and all those other kind of things, people are still getting points, and there's enough flow in the point economy where you can keep progressing in the game. In Monopoly, hell knows what's going to happen. You could steal some money from someone else, they could steal money from you, and at the end of the day, you're just fighting for getting the most money, I guess, trying to make sure you're staying alive. I haven't seen a game on Monopoly where there's more than two people, or even more than one person who just has all the money and everyone else is the meekly pawns in the game of chance and capitalism. I prefer other methods, of course, but besides the point, me, the simple squire, I can't really deny these things. The simple prince who doesn't really know the world as much as their father does. Of course, of course. Keep these traits in mind as we move forward, of course. What if I did the entire show with that voice? To break character, to just put that out there for a second. Imagine me doing the entire voice like this. Perhaps I shall. Maybe one day, audience, I'll grace you with this wonderful, magnificent voice of mine, but for now, I must keep it repressed. So, I might not explicitly mention all these specific traits and characteristics of a Euro game within this specific review, but they are important to the way that we can define Thronefall and the extents of this game. We're not going to keep it restrained in it, which is why I'm not going to explain it that thoroughly and kind of draw those similarities. You can draw them yourself, which is fantastic. Because we gotta kind of connect the overarching Eurocentric indie games. They're becoming way more popular nowadays. They're kind of taking over these AAA titans, as we've kind of discussed earlier, kind of allowing the market to grow a bit better, which I appreciate a lot. So, without further ado, let's get into the game. The whole game, this game of Thronefall, is segmented up episodically and broken up into two game modes, as you might say. One is the campaign, the original fall through all the levels, etc., and the roguelike campaign, where you can play indefinitely until you lose and you can replay the game over and over again, getting a higher and higher score. Interestingly enough, I only discovered the second mode after I started doing research on this topic, on this game. So, you know, I'll be mainly focusing on the main campaign, as much to the dismay as all the roguelike fans out there. I'm so sorry I let you guys down. I didn't mean to. What? Listen, you'll get your chance. You'll get your chance. Don't worry about it. I'll make sure you're represented as your elected official in this one, as the single candidate for Independent Incidentals. I'll make sure your voice is heard, roguelike fans. As a sidebar, I'm realizing it's quite apparent that I don't have time to play or switch between games. Normally, what usually happens is I usually, like my Slay the Spire addiction, I either get attached to a game for a couple of months on end, or I just get bored of it immediately and then move on to the next thing without even giving like 30 minutes of gameplay. So I'm pretty, what's the word? I feel like this game was about to take over my brain, but because we have to keep moving forward, it's not going to, because we have to keep moving forward. You got to keep that forward momentum. We can't stall any specific game, because we have a lot of games to cover. We can't just stall on one specific game. We got to worry about Halloween. What fun. Anyway, nonetheless, let's continue the game overview. Also, by the way, the Halloween is going to be, about the same. It's still going to be a game. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get my hands on a specific game that I want to play for Halloween, but hopefully you will still be entertained nonetheless. All right. Thronefall. Question 2. How does it progress? Well, each level requires the king, the player, on horseback to build your little kingdom. And the main goal is to survive each night while ensuring your city center isn't destroyed. If you lose, it will be destroyed. And if it gets destroyed, you lose. It's pretty standard tower defense procedure, if I may say so myself. This is the preliminary day phase, or we'll call it the building phase for clarity. In this building phase, there's a lot of little points on the map where you can build specific structures, towers, whatever you want to call them. These towers can be split up into different purposes for building your kingdom, economic, defense, and of course, offense. Economy is how you buy and build stuff in the game to begin with. Without money, you're stuck, and the enemies will only hit harder and harder. Houses, mills, and mines are all perfect examples of towers and buildings that grant you money each day, each building phase. Whoop. There we go. The defense is the walls that can protect your towers. Since any economic towers that can be destroyed won't produce any money, defense is occasionally needed if you're not fast enough to kill the enemies and you're desperate in need to protect your bag. I always protect my bag, audience. Offense, again, is pretty self-explanatory. Towers that can shoot arrows at oncoming enemies automatically, barracks to train soldiers and archers, this is where probably you're going to get most of the complexity in the game. Where do you put your troops to defeat this specific enemy type? Where do you build your towers so that this one enemy that self-destructs won't get destroyed and leave you open? All these are very important questions when building your kingdom. And of course, all these buildings can be upgraded. I do love upgrades, yes. I love a tower that shoots faster or a tower that does more damage. What this game absolutely nails is customization, while keeping it within the game's boundaries and rules. It provides a lot of small changes that you can add to your initial loadout to give each player their unique flair in the game, their own specific playstyle, while keeping it pretty slick and minimalist at its core mechanics. Each level adds something a little unique, like different upgrades and enemies, to allow you to master the elements introduced in the previous one. Weapons, perks, and challenges are a component of this loadout feature. Before the game starts, you must pick all of these before you start. Firstly, you have to pick your weapon. This is what the knight, the king of the realm will defend itself with, and what you will be using to defeat the enemies alongside your towers and your troops. You unlock weapons as you progress, starting with the bow and progressing to broadswords and lightning staffs. Yes, I love lightning staffs. Oh, it's so fun to electrocute enemies and see them wriggle and struggle. I'm also homicidal. I don't know if you knew that. I'm a prince. What do you expect? I want to kill the king. Perhaps I hired these enemies to take out the king and make their throne mine, yes. Each of these cool items and accessories, weapons, has their own unique secondary ability that provides extra utility and technical prowess if you can use them effectively. Like when you got the spear that gives you, when you activate it, a little healing bonus plus extra attack speed. It allows you to get there when getting rough and destroy a bunch of enemies without the risk of dying. Just really tear them up. I remember before, it was crazy. I was able to, like, you can also, like, be able to redirect enemies too, because then now once you hit an enemy, they'll focus on you rather than focusing on a specific tower. So I just rush in there, try to stab as many of them as possible, get a bunch of people following me, and that'll be enough time for my archers to get trained up again and to take on the enemy head on, which is fantastic strategy in my opinion. Next up is your perks. These are little bonuses that allow you to opt into a specific playstyle, as we've mentioned before, with the customization options. Like sometimes I get ahead of the script, besides the point. Do you like getting your hands dirty? Do you like letting all the towers do the work and you can sit on your porcelain throne just looking back at what you created? Or maybe you want to lead your 64-man army into the battle because it feels more appropriate for your militant lifestyle choices. Personally, I like the economic bonuses. I like things that allow me to get rich quick because it just allows me to have more control of what I can build and what I can buy and what I can spend on. Oh, I love spending. As royalty myself, I do love spending. It's one of my favorite options in my life. Capitalism for the win. The third component of this loadout feature are challenges. These are specific quote-unquote prayers or offerings you can do to get extra challenges in the game. Why would you want to activate challenges? That just sounds like extra work. Yes, I hear you saying that, audience, of course. However, these loadouts tie into specific quests that you can unlock by fulfilling specific requirements for them. For example, there's a specific challenge called the Challenge of the Snake God, which requires you to give up some money that you would normally get from killing enemies. However, it allows you to complete one of these quests on one of these specific levels. There's a few other ones as well that increase the enemy's damage, the enemy's health, makes it so that the buildings don't repair every day phase, and also a few other ones. But it also provides you with more points and when you complete the game with these, what they call mutators on. These points can be transferred into experience points, which then allow you to unlock way more perks way faster, which I usually like to do. I usually like putting on the snake mode just to give myself a little extra challenge. Like, I have to make sure I build up my economy fast enough to make sure I can rely on just myself. And it gives me like a 30 XP bonus. 30% XP bonus, which is fantastic. It allows me to upgrade so many more things. And that's pretty much the entire game. You progress with 10 levels within this entire main campaign. And there's a bunch of quests and extra challenges you can complete once you do it. I think they specifically said it takes about 8 to 10 hours to complete the main campaign. Like I said before, they want to make sure that you have a very minimal, like 30-minute experience for each level, kind of like testing the boundaries of what you can do. And it's a nice little strategy game. It's a nice way to kill a little bit of time without making, without wasting your time. I remember a lot of times where I have like a few midterms ahead of me and I'm like, what am I doing here? Well, I mean, this game is pretty quick, so I might as well play it. And I just play it for like 30 minutes and it's nice. It's enticing. It feels good. It feels good when you win. And then when you don't, you're like, okay, I rage quit. Time to play. Time to actually work on stuff. And it just goes. More for casual gamers. I like it. We need more casual gamer picks. More picks for casual gamers, in my opinion. Anyway, like I mentioned before, there was the full release for this game that came out on October 11th. Again, I could be wrong about it, but October 11th was when the 1.0 version came out. So you know I had to get in there and let you guys know what changed. The first thing I noticed about this game was the actual map that showed up in your UI HUD. Before, when the levels were getting bigger and bigger, I noticed I was getting mobbed by so many people. And like in a specific memory, I remember like me focusing on this one area of the map, and on the opposite end of the map, there was like 11 hill giants that were coming with gigantic clubs, destroying all my buildings. And I was like, no! And I had to run all the way across the realm just to defeat them. They were so close to defeating my center. God. Now, thankfully, the game gives you an indicator at the bottom right corner to where the enemies are, where your troops are, and where you are. Again, it's quite sleek in design, like the rest of this game. It gives you all the information you need without too much fluff, and I like that. Normally, like, the maps take up, like, half the screen, and you have to, like, focus, like, okay, that's... It gives you, like, exact... I'm not calling out any games, of course. I'm just saying, like, it gives you too much information. This one just gives you a nice layout, like, kind of like Doom style, in a way. Even Doom, in a way, gives you way too much information on the map. I feel like this one perfectly indicates, okay, this is upper level, this is lower level, you can go up this way, all that kind of stuff. And even then, there are specific towers that allow you to traverse the map way easier. Which I also kind of figured out as I've been continuing to play this game. Another major change is more perks. Way more perks. Before, I believe you can only bring about 2 or 3 perks into battle. Now you can bring up to 5 perks. The levels that were extremely difficult last time I played this game last year were a cakewalk, now that I had a lot more abilities to rely on. One specific one I remember. A little sippy break. One specific one I remember was the King of Resurrection, which allowed you, the king, once you die in combat or battle, you immediately get resurrected once. Of course, you automatically get resurrected once you die. It takes about, I think, 7-6 seconds in order to get back up. But in this case, with this perk enabled, I was able to immediately get back up and continue to fight, making sure my kingdom was protected. My kingdom was safe. My citizens, they need to be taxed. So I need to make sure they're alive so they can continue paying my taxes. Yes, I do love the economy. Let's talk about early access. Now, this game was in early access for at least a year, if I remember correctly. It got released, I think, in 2023, and the full game came out in 2024. What is my opinion on early access games? Early access games are games that are put up on display, allowing you to pay for the game before it's even made. Imagine being able to buy the original Mario Brothers when, like, literally all you have is level 1-1. That's the more pessimistic side of looking at it. There is definitely two sides to this coin. The pessimistic side is the idea of saying people could literally make an unfinished game, publish it, and then people can crowdsource and fund it. And the original people can just literally pull the plug on it. Don't have to promise anything. And if the game gets abandoned, or even worse, the people who are programming it are pieces of yeah. That happens a lot, more surprisingly than not. More or so happens on Kickstarter than anything else, because it's way easier to just take all the money and run. However, there is a very good side to this. I feel like early access games allow a lot of new, budding indie development creators to take more risks with what they're doing. It allows them to put themselves on the pedestal earlier in the development, allowing people to give the money that they need to continue development, and allowing the finished product to rake in even more money for themselves. Because they earned it at that point. They built the game. They allowed, like with this game, for example, they built the entire game, and they have made their money's worth, so to speak. This game already felt pretty complete on the first release. Of course, there was a few issues I already had with it. For example, you know, sometimes the challenges were just way too difficult. Like some of the... You get crowns for the quests that you complete by picking a specific loadout for this specific level. For example, like I said before, if you pick a spear and this specific mutator, this specific challenge, then you complete this specific quest, right? And you get a crown for it. Some of those challenges, like just making the enemies way more damaging, absolutely destroyed me. And I kind of lost my passion for the game once I realized this, which is honestly why I think restarting games is something we should do way more often. Personally, I feel like unless it's a game like Slay the Spire where you can just like pick it up and say, okay, these cards do exactly what they say, and you can just learn it on the fly, games like Thronefall and all that kind of stuff, you have to get in a rhythm. You have to feel the game before you actually play it. You have to continue learning the rules as you're playing it. And in a way, it's kind of more, requires more work than, say, a Slay the Spire or even like a, what's another game that kind of you just kind of jump in? Like, I don't know, a simple board game that you've been playing for all your time, and like Monopoly, for example. You kind of know the rules. You know how to work the board, you know? You get it. With Thronefall, you have to, like, kind of reteach yourself the mechanics of the game in order to get back into the groove. Which I feel like being able to restart the game, with limitations, of course. I've been very, very guilty of this, where I kind of restarted the game and then immediately restarted again and again and again because I don't feel like I'm getting it enough. I'm scared of failing the game. That's the main thing. My gamer pride is on the line, and I feel like I have to defend it at all costs. My realization is that I realize that I rely too much on trying to win constantly. It feels good to win, of course. But I feel like losing is where you kind of enjoy the game most. And I've kind of destroyed that for myself because I expect the win so many times. It's kind of a double-edged sword in a way. If I expect to win, then I don't really find the game as attractive as it was. If that makes sense. Like if you constantly keep winning over and over and over again, it loses its luster so quickly. But if you keep losing, you feel like there's nothing you can do to change it, and you just quit, which is the difference between casual gamers and, like, Dark Souls players or whatever. Who knows? I'm just going on a complete tangent. We're talking about early access. What's the deal with early access? I believe that if you're using early access as a way to crowdfund your game and give the people what they want while also getting what you want, which is more money to fund the game, allowing the game to continue its development cycle, then by all means. But there's, like, gray areas to this, you know? There's, like, specific areas where you're like, okay, this game has been in early access for how long? 6 years? And you haven't come out with the game yet? I think you should have had it in the oven for a couple more years and then came out with it later. I don't know. Sometimes it just feels like these games are coming out way too early for you to actually make a specific judgment call on them. So, make sure your game is at least baked with the idea. Make sure you have a concrete decision made about the game. And once you release it, make sure that you're continuing to communicate with your fan base, continue to communicate with your community, and give them what they want while also giving what your vision wants. Is the main takeaway, I feel, with early access. Of course, there's many more early access games. They came into full release soon, so I'll have to cover them. Some games like, Ark Nova. No, it was Nova Drift. Damn it! Ark Nova is like some kind of gacha game, isn't it? I forget. Besides the point, there's many, many more games to cover that they just came out into 1.0. So, while people might think there is a games drought, I believe we're just starting. So, we'll continue discussing all these intricate, fun little niche games that you might have. Now, here's the final question. We've covered the background, we've covered how the game progresses, and we covered how full release works and early access works. How does this game fit in the overall tower defense genre? I feel like the main takeaway of V-Like is the sense of inclusion in its actual design. What I mean by this is in a lot of games, like, for example, Balloons Tower Defense. Balloons Tower Defense 6, Balloons Tower Defense, Balloons Monkey City, Balloons Tower Defense 5, 4, 3, etc. Plants vs. Zombies, all of those kind of games. You aren't really involved in the actual combat. You aren't involved in the, what would you say? I guess you aren't really involved in defending, you know? You're more tasked with making sure that you have enough defenses and offenses, it's way more strategical, which is fine. Those games, I love those games. Those games I grew up on. Those games are my bread and butter, so to speak. However, there is a lot to be said about a game that allows you, the player, to kind of take on these challenges and, you know, actually face your foe head on instead of just being hiding behind the towers that you put up. Imagine if you're playing this game, but you're just like the king who's just in the tower. A lot of case. I don't know if that'd be a good look on Grizzly Games, I'll tell you that much. But putting him in on the forefront, making him the main defender of this kingdom, and making him, like, you know, decree what things should be built at what specific moments is perfect in the specific design of the game. I feel like in a lot of ways as well, it kind of also speaks to royalty! I love royalty. Can you please give me the crown? Father, I'd love the crown, please.
No, you can't have the crown.
Why does he sound like the Costco guy? God damn it.
We're royalty guys. Of course we gotta get the crown. We gotta get the crown with extra diamonds on it.
Ooh, I love the... Dad, I love the crown with extra diamonds on it. Oops, I accidentally stabbed you. How unfortunate. Oh, I accidentally pushed you into the spike pit. Oh, it's literally me. I guess I'm king now. That's crazy to think about, by the way. Just thinking about, like, how foolish an idea was to put, like, the one thing. Yes, I'm gonna rule until I am dead. What's the one thing that could, like, develop an idea, a homicidal ideal, to become king? Oh yeah, of course, I'm going to commit regicide and also whatever the father side, I guess patricide, would you call it? Killing two birds with one stone. Jesus, like it's crazy. It's crazy to think about. Besides the point. What was I talking about? Right, well, how does this fit in the tower defense genre? I feel like other than that, it's more of a strategy game than anything else. Because I feel like it's way too, what's the word? I think tower defense kind of also has the ideal of having a specific track in mind. Like with a lot of tower defense games, you have a specific pathfinding that the balloons or zombies or whatever enemy you encounter in these games follows. For example, with the Plants vs. Zombies games, you have 5 lanes that you have to protect at all costs. With the balloons games, you have a specific path that it follows, and you can place the monkeys wherever you want. With this game, you have specific places you can place the towers, kind of like Kingdom Rush, one of those old Newgrounds games that kind of got a resurgence in the recent years as well. But also, those games also have a specific pathfinding they follow. In this game, the enemies can follow whatever path they want. They obviously come from specific areas of the map, but they have to still follow the path. They're not just focusing on one specific path, if that makes sense. Sippy break. By the way, make sure you hydrate, everybody. So what's the main takeaway? I feel like this game shows that a lot of these Euro games, a lot of new Euro digital Euro games, can become a very interesting concept to look into, especially on the digital landscape. I feel like Grizzly Games has come up with a lot of interesting concepts over the years, and I feel like if they continue to innovate in this place, I'm just saying, the games industry could look a lot different. Of course, there's a lot of other games that could be doing the exact same thing. So that is where I will end it today. A little bit of a shorter one, but of course we got a lot more ground to cover. Now before I go, there's a lot of you probably thinking out there, what is he gonna cover? What is he gonna cover next week? It's Halloween. Well, the day before Halloween, but you can still get spooky. I'm sorry. I'm gonna get spooky. I don't care what you think. I'm gonna get spooky. So, what's gonna happen? How are we gonna do this? I'm gonna play Pizza Tower, and there's nothing you can do to stop me. The scariest thing of all. Yes, I'm not joking. Because last week, during reading week, I was planning to play a specific horror eldritch kind of game called Darkest Dungeon, if you've heard of that one. kind of an interesting turn-based strategy game where you have a crew members that you could, like, you know, make sure you don't die, but also make sure you don't go insane while you're trying to traverse this kind of eldritch horror dungeon. Zombies and ghouls and all that kind of fun stuff. But unfortunately, I was not able to get to it in time, unfortunately. I was busy finishing Helix, which is something I should probably cover a little bit. But I'll cover that before we get into the main topic right now, which is what I'm going to cover next week, which is Pizza Tower. Hey, what are you going to do? You can't stop me. I'm sorry. There's a Halloween update that I have to get to right now. And there's nothing you can do to stop me from getting all those pumpkins and all those specific levels. I'm sorry. You can't stop me. My hands are tied. Pepino's got me in a lock hold. I'm sorry. Chokehold. That's the word. You can't fake the funk. And you can't stop me if I'm going to not discuss Pizza Tower for the fourth time. Third, fourth time. Whatever. Besides the point. How was Helix? I'm probably hearing you guys ask. Helix 2 was a very interesting ending. Like I mentioned before, there was a whole ordeal with Gibby. He explodes. He throws dynamite at you and causes you to go to the afterlife. And then takes hold of what was it called again? The Helix Chameleon? Whatever it was called. No, it was the Hylix Asylum. Whatever. Point is that once everyone gets turned into an abomination that only speaks gibberish, you're able to bypass a specific vault that's guarded by this specific creature and take all the money from the stronghold. Yes, I love taking money as royalty. Taxes. So these anarchists steal all the money, but there's also a bomb that you can use in a specific area that explodes a new path to what's called the Sage Labyrinth, which I didn't realize would take me at least 3 hours to complete. I hate that place so much. I literally had to pull out. I don't know why they don't do this. They should literally give you a map. Like, I don't know why. It turns into a first-person dungeon crawler where you have to avoid enemies, continue down specific paths, get lost. Oh, it sucks. Because even when I figured it out, I got to the next sage. It turns out I actually found the secret sage. And I had to find another pathway to another secret boss, which then unlocks you to find the hidden ability, which is called, I think, what was it called again? Protobomb, I think it's called. You have to unlock all three sages at those specific points, which then give you this specific gesture, which allows you to explode everything, literally. It absorbs all your party's mana, your will, as I mentioned in the last episode, and literally explodes everything, dealing like 200 damage to everything, which made all of the hallway encounters very, very trivial. Allowed me to upgrade everything and then take on Gibby with pretty much certainty, confidence, which I kind of enjoyed because I was already starting to get a little bit tired of the RPG turn-based strategy gameplay in a way. It was kind of getting a little bit boring. So I think it was a perfect place to end it. I think 8 hours is like the perfect length for any sort of game like that. Granted, you don't have to get the protobomb. It just makes it very easy because the final boss fight with Gibby makes him, like when you attack him, forces him to summon enemies. So you're constantly fighting, you're constantly snapping at him, and he's constantly spitting out little giblets that heal him and give him like special abilities and also attack you. And it just was very nice to have that very final explosion that allowed to just to destroy everything on screen. It was very, very satisfying. Anyway, that was Helix 2. I hope I give it a little bit justice. We're going to be doing a little bit more research-based oriented projects, I think. Unfortunately, Pizza Tower is not one of those. We're gonna get a little silly with that one because I think the topic on hand is already not too dense. So, get ready for a spooky episode, and I'll see you next week. You know what the spookiest thing of all is, ladles and germs? Midterms! Oh, God. I hope you guys are doing all right out there. I'll see you all next week, and what should we play? What song to play? Great question. Let me log in real quick, actually. I didn't log into my Spotify. You can't find the OST for Thronefall anywhere on Spotify. But if I wanted to pick a little royal song, why? Listen, we don't have to play a royal song. Here's the thing. There's a little bit of context for Master Boot Record. Master Boot Record made a specific song for a game that I covered last year called Ultra Kill. Ultra Kill is another indie darling that is beloved by all indie game fans, and specifically Doom fans, because it kind of takes within that specific PS1 style hack and slash shoot 'em up genre. And the intensity that Master Boot Record goes into, and I like his albums as well, on the premise that, well, let me see, hold on. Am I talking about the right guy? No, I am. No, wait, it's Keegan Church. Who's Master Boot Record then, Master? I'm so sorry, audience, I didn't realize I was so wrong. Master Boot Record, I think, is Keegan Church? Maybe? Let me look this up for you all real quick. Who is Keegan Church? Keegan Church is an artist who became really... Okay, that's Reddit. Never mind. You know what? I think either way, Keegan Church does a great job of blending in that kind of royalty. This is the guy I was talking about. It's really easy to get them confused. Master Boot Record, I think he made one song for... I'm not too sure, but I know for a fact that Keegan Church made a couple of songs for Ultra Kill, which is fantastic because it blends that kind of ideal royal, and I guess divine sound of the organ with more heavy elements because you're kind of in hell and you're fighting a bunch of enemies while going through all the different layers, which is very, very fun. And also, I need to get back into that game. However, the P ranks are not going to come out not quickly. So for now, I'll play you a few of these songs from these specific tracks that I liked. Starting with Hare Klavit, Jaburudite. You know what? How about I just do the ones from the actual Ultra Kill soundtrack? Tene Rosso Sangui is one from the Ultra Kill soundtrack, and the other one is Ultra Church. I hope you all enjoy, and I'll see you in the next episode. We're gonna get spooky for it. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.